Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at TraceMinerals.com. You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to TraceMinerals.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week on Mysteries and Monsters, we return to the forests of North America on the search for Bigfoot, in the company of the marvellous Amy Boo. Amy has made a real name for herself in the last few years as a diligent, humble, and driven researcher in the field of cryptozoology. Since witnessing a strange creature nearly 10 years ago in Ohio, Amy has dedicated herself in the pursuit of pushing the boundaries of knowledge in the search for Bigfoot. A former member of the BFRO, Amy is now aligned with the Olympic Project and is also the co-founder of Project Zoobook, a collaborative team that includes primatologists, biologists, cryptozoologists, and more. We discuss some of Amy's favourite witness interviews, her quest to learn all about Bigfoot, her work with both the Olympic Project and Project Zoobook, as well as plenty of discussion about Bigfoot and her dream Bigfoot bucket list expeditions. Amy was wonderful company, and I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. As always, don't forget, you can support the show by clicking on the show note link for our Patreon for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, bonus content, and prize draws. We're also available across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube, and our website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com. A big thank you, as always, for the marvellous artwork to Dean Bestel. And the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is always delighted to be a part of the spookily fantastic Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's get out there with Amy on the quest to find evidence for Bigfoot. On this week's show, we make a welcome return to the world of Bigfoot in the company of the marvellous Amy Bew. Since the turn of the year, Amy has been the most requested guest from you, my marvellous listeners. Amy is the co-founder of Project Zoobook and a member of the Olympic Project, a language art teacher by trade, and has become a well-known and highly regarded speaker and writer on the subject of Bigfoot. Amy, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are you?
I'm doing well. That was such a nice intro. Thank you, Paul.
You are very welcome. Thank you. Like I say, I often get emails from listeners asking me to get certain people on, but it was one of those things where, you know, I certainly got more than one or two. I got quite a few emails from people asking me, especially after I'd had Shane Corson and David Ellis on the show in regards to the Olympic Project, mm-hmm. asking me if I would have you on the show. And I was thinking, well, absolutely, because you were somebody that I've been aware of for a few years, certainly the last couple. And obviously, I'm always delighted to speak to anybody on the subject of Bigfoot if they're willing to put up with me.
Absolutely. It's fun. It's a fun subject, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think when I've heard you speak before, you bring a real humility and humour to the subject as well, Amy, because you're a very down-to-earth person with a deep passion in the subject, aren't you?
I do have a deep passion in the subject. I call myself the Don Quixote of Bigfoot, I think. trying to figure this out, and I just think it's fascinating. And I appreciate you saying that I'm down to earth. I try to be. I feel like, you know, you have a lot of personalities in the Bigfoot community. And a lot of those personalities I'm very fond of. And you were talking about Shane and David, and those are two of my very good friends. But I feel like sometimes people get a little bit, too much of a big head over what they're doing. I don't know how else to say that. So the fact that you say I'm down to earth is exactly what I want to be, because we're all, you know, there's no experts is what I'm trying to say. You know, we're all trying to figure this out together.
Absolutely. And I think when it comes to a subject like this, as you refer to there, I think one of the big issues we have is often there are, as with any kind of aspect of cryptozoology, it's not just Bigfoot. I think you can apply this across the whole spectrum of unknown creatures across the world, Amy, that there are a lot of people that want to be the one that proves it. And I think when you have such a collective and collaborative approach to the subject as you do, and the Olympic Project and the work that you're doing out there in the field, it's very refreshing that it seems to be a very kind of positive aspect and trying to work together as easily as possible to benefit everybody in regards to this subject.
Yeah, it's so important too, I think. You know, that's one of the reasons when the Olympic Project came calling and asked if I'd like to be a part of them. You know, I said, could I think about it for a little bit? And it was probably like 10 seconds I thought about it. Because they are just down to earth, like you said, people that are, they're out in the field. They are the real deal. They are so kind and inclusive, and they really share their knowledge. You know, so I wanted to be a part of that, and just I admire what they're doing so much. And as far as my own project, you know, we have some crossover there with both David and Shane being part of Project Zoo Book as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my whole goal, you know, the project came about in an accidental way. And as it's grown, my whole goal has been to get more people involved, to get, you know, people to share with each other. It's my best times when Project Zoo Book calls, or when some of our scientists kind of hook up together to do a project off on the side. You know, you just, if you want something to really work like this, you can't be all possessive of people. You know, I'm just basically a coordinator of it, and it makes me happy when people are out there sharing information and doing things together.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, in the scheme of the world of Bigfoot, you're quite a late, I was going to say late bloomer, but I don't think that's uh-huh. the right term.
I think that's a good term, yeah.
Because unlike some people who become obsessed with Bigfoot at an early age, I know you were aware of Bigfoot and you'd seen a few things as a child that had scared the pants off you.
Yes, movies, yes.
But you'd kind of not really delved into it. And then something happened to you about 10 years ago that really changed your perspective on this subject and the world around you.
100%. Yes. If you would have ever told me that I would be spending so much of my time trying to figure out Bigfoot, I would never have believed you. Because yes, like you said, I was aware of that term, and you know, I thought Bigfoot was made up. You know, I thought it was a myth, or I thought it was just something for fun to scare kids over, you know. But about 10 years ago, you're right, 9 to 10 years, I saw something that really changed the course of my life. And it was, I can't say for sure that it was Bigfoot. I was a passenger in a car and saw this out the window, you know, some large creature. And I say it was a creature because it moved. It wasn't like a cutout or anything like that. It moved. You could tell it was alive, was standing along a body of water and holding onto a tree. But I cannot say for sure what it was because I was too far away. You know, in that car, we were at least 100 yards, I would say. So, and you're moving along. You couldn't stop. It was on, we were on a bridge. And, you know, I play that back in my head a lot, that I wish we could have pulled over and stopped and seen exactly what it was. but it was impressive enough to me that it is the catalyst that got me started into doing some research on my own and then getting involved with some other people. And now here I am. I often say that depending on the day, I really think that Bigfoot is real. And other days I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh my gosh, like, what am I spending all this time on? You know, is it really real? You know, it really does. I'm just being very honest because I wouldn't say that I believe in Bigfoot. I think that Bigfoot is most likely real, if you want to put it that way, or that it could be real. But I'm the type of person where I have enough skepticism that I would really need to see it for myself to be 100% convinced, like see it in a better sighting where, yes, you know, you're like sure what it is. But yeah, it really changed my life in many ways. And it's funny, I say I should have a bumper sticker on my car saying Bigfoot changed my life or something like that. But I'm fascinated by it. So I'm going to, you know, I don't see myself stopping this quest to try to figure out what they are and if they actually exist.
Yeah, I think I know exactly how you feel because I'm very much of a similar mindset that the majority of the time, Amy, I am convinced that something or Bigfoot or whatever we want to call it, Sasquatch, or regardless of where it is in the world, it exists. And then there are days just like you where I wake up and I think, what am I thinking? What is going on? There's no real tantalizingly physical proof that we can say categorically 100% without any controversy or people claiming it's somebody in a suit or it's a misidentified bear or anything. And I sometimes think, why am I so convinced? What, you know, normally there are other subjects that I am deeply skeptical about, and yet when it comes to Bigfoot, it's intoxicating, I think, sometimes, and it's very difficult not to get carried away and swept up in certain things that happen every now and again. I completely understand where you're coming from, and I think that's a very honest and refreshing approach to it, because often people are so convinced of the reality of it that I think sometimes when it oversteps the boundaries of actual evidence and proof to become a belief system, which I think can often lead people to find things that fit their idea or their belief rather than looking at the evidence and saying, well, actually, this doesn't prove anything.
Right, absolutely. And you do get caught up in things. And I have before, you know, I'll be out in the forest and hear something and I'll be like, ooh, you know, like my first thought is maybe this is it, you know, maybe that's what I'm hearing or maybe that's what I'm seeing. But then I catch myself and I try to logically think what else it could be. And usually I can come up with something else. And I just strongly feel that if it could be some other type of animal we know about or a human being or something with a natural cause, it probably is. You know, I feel like we should err on that side. Mm. But I get excited. You know, I get excited out there too. But I agree with you. I think that what keeps me so fascinated is that when I first saw whatever it was I saw, and then I started digging into Bigfoot, and then I realized there's a lot of people that are saying they're seeing this, and even where I saw it, which was in Ohio, you know, in the United States, which of all places I would not think anybody would see something there. But there's a lot of sightings in Ohio, so I'm like, okay, so I kept reading everything I could and talking to people. And, you know, once you start really looking into it, you realize that it is not like you're looking into the Easter Bunny, you yes. know, which in my head, I thought they were the same thing, you know, like it was that type of a thing. But there's actually, you have all of these witnesses, you have footprint evidence, audio, which is my favorite part of Bigfoot research. That's very compelling to me, some of the audio. So it's not just, you know, you can just dismiss it. There's really possibilities there. And to me, that's very exciting.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. And I think, as with anything, I think that says a lot about it as well, Amy, because often people, when they have a preconceived idea about the subject of Bigfoot, as you refer to there, most people think, oh, it's all in the Pacific Northwest and that's it. And then when you have an incident that occurs, such as what happened to yourself, I suppose you were very surprised to realise just how prevalent sightings are in Ohio, because I know the Salt Fork State Park is a hotspot for sightings and has been for decades in the area. So when you kind of got bitten by the bug, was it a little bit inspiring, or were you shocked to realise just how prevalent Bigfoot sightings were in Ohio and in the states that surrounded it?
Oh, I was shocked. I could not believe it. I had never heard of that, you know, of anybody in Ohio that said they saw anything. So I'm like, this can't be. You know, I saw what I saw, and I said as we drove past, I'm like, I think I just saw a Bigfoot. You know, so I mean, that's how much I thought that's what it looked like, is in my head, that's what it seemed like. But I'm like, oh, that's stupid. You know, like immediately, that's stupid. Ha ha ha. So, but then when I, you know, I think it was that same day or at least within the next few days that I started Googling, you know, Bigfoot, Ohio, I was shocked. And since this has happened, I've talked to several people who say they've seen one right around that same area with much better sightings than I had myself. And, you know, I still, in my head, logically, you know, I talked to Peter Byrne about this one time. It makes more sense to me that Bigfoot would be, if it exists, that they would be in the Pacific Northwest, like you said. And I spend as much time as I can out there because when you're in those forests, you're like, oh man, there could be anything out here. I know Shane Corson, like you mentioned, he talks frequently about how many small aircraft are lost in the Olympic National Forest or on the Olympic Peninsula. Mm-hmm. You know, those are aircraft and they're stationary and we can't find them. So why couldn't there be some unknown primate running around, you know? But when you come to Ohio, although we do have a lot of forested area, my main place I look in Ohio is in Columbiana County, and there are a lot of reports that come out of there that's right bumps up against Pennsylvania. Then you get into the Allegheny National Forest. So, you know, when I'm out there and I camp as often as I can and I'll be out, you know, backpacking in, you think, yeah, there could be something here. But still in my brain, it doesn't seem as likely as out west. But I cannot get away, you know, put my sighting or whatever it was out, you know, like do away with that. I've seen something else through a FLIR camera in southern Ohio. That was impressive as well, like several years later. But put those away. And when I talk to people, you know, I do a lot of sportsman shows. So myself and my research partner, Tina Sams, who's also my best friend, we go to different like hunting and fishing shows. And you get these hunters and fishermen who will come up to you and they'll tell you about what they saw. And you can see, like, the emotion on their faces. Some of these guys, you know, were lifetime hunters, and they don't go back in the woods anymore because they say they saw a Sasquatch, you know, in the Allegheny National Forest or wherever it is. And it's very hard to just dismiss them, and especially because there's so many. You know, like, if all of these people are lying, which I don't think they are, why? You know, I can't grasp that. And, you know, and especially when you get somebody who's been in the woods a lot, I don't think they're misidentifying a black bear. You know, could some of the sightings be that? Okay. But not all of them. You know, I know what I saw was not a black bear. I'm very familiar with black bear. So you know, you take away any footprint evidence or any hair samples or any audio, and you're just talking about these people. You know, I forget who was the first person to say this, but somebody said, if you take just one of the thousands and tens of thousands of reports, if one of them is true, then Bigfoot is real.
Yeah.
And I can't get that out of my mind. You know, if one of them is true.
Absolutely. I think that's the aspect of all this that is so addictive that
Yes. It
only takes one report and that's it. Everything else is irrelevant. Then it's a reality. And I'm always struck, as you refer to there, when I hear reports or interviews with people who have a long history of the outdoors, be it a hunter, a warden, a fisherman, people who have spent their entire lives, because in certain states and certain towns in America, there are people that have grown up going out into the woods from being small children, with a gun in their hand at 8, 9, 10 years old, out with their family, their grandfathers, their parents, and it's kind of a generational thing, and it's a family thing, and it's something that they fall in love with. And then something happens to them that they can't explain. And I often find it frustrating, Amy, as you touch on there, that these people are experienced outdoorsmen, especially the people that go out there for sustenance, hunting. I've never been able to accept the excuse that these people are wrong or they're mistaken, because I'm thinking, well, if these people have been going out hunting for 40 years, how on earth have they managed to survive this long if they misidentifying creatures that they would probably know with their eyes closed? You know what I mean? They've got a real ability and an inherent knowledge of the world around them that they use and they traverse, that when something happens to them, often they are shocked emotionally. And I know, as you touch on there, it changes their perspective both on how they view the woods and the forests around them and the parks that they normally would frequent very regularly, to essentially sometimes being so frightened by what happened, even if it's not a physical encounter, it may be a sound or a smell or just something happening in the distance, that their whole life is changed in that moment.
Yeah, it's very compelling. Like I said, the one gentleman that we talked to, he had been, like you said, over 40 years going out hunting. He saw this thing through his window on his own property. And when I met him at the hunting show, he was shaken, visibly shaken. And he said, I come to these shows every year. I try to go out and hunt. He said, opening day of deer season was his Christmas. He loved it that much, and he cannot bring himself to go back in the woods. And a lot of times, somebody like him, Tina and I were the first people that he told his story to. Mm. People don't want to be made fun of. Like, I'm at the point where I don't care if people make fun of me anymore, but people don't want that, or you could lose your job over it if people think you're crazy, But he was very, very sincere. And could he have been lying? I can't say he wasn't, but my gut feeling is that he was not. Maybe it's my teacher instincts. I can usually tell when somebody's lying to me.
Yeah.
But another example, if it's okay if I give it.
Of course, fire away.
Okay, there was another gentleman who I met. I met him and his wife at a small town outside of Cook Forest, Pennsylvania. And he had submitted a report, so I went out there to meet them. And he was telling me about how he was a foreman for a construction company, and they were taking down a water tower, like a small water tower that was in this area of the forest. And his job, he took the night shift. So he was in his truck, and there was like a generator that was this was in February. So they had to melt the water that had turned to ice that was in this tower. So he took the night shift. The generator was on, was trying to heat up the water to melt it so they could get rid of this thing. And he was all wrapped up in some blankets in his truck. And every 15 minutes or so, he would, he set his alarm on his phone to wake him up so he could look and make sure the fire was still going. So there was one time where his alarm did not go off, but what woke him up was something that shoved his truck. And it was all dark in there. He was like, had all these blankets to keep warm since it's cold at that time of year. And something shoved the truck really hard, and he could hear something walking away, as he said he like knocked his phone out of his hand, and he's like looking around, and he looks up and he sees like a silhouette of something, kind of walking away because it was dark. Mm. Well, when this thing reached to the point that it light that was cast by the generator, he could see its profile was looking toward that light. And when he got back up after getting his phone, he, made some movement in the truck. He said the thing turned and he could see how wide it was. And, he was shaken while he was telling me that part, even And his wife was there and his dog was there as they were telling. And I had a bear specialist from Canada. And she came along with me because I try to be safe and not go by myself to meet strangers in the woods.
Advisable, so, yes.
Yes. So as we were telling that part, I had her go stand near the tree. He remembered the branch of the tree that this thing was standing under. And she's a tall lady, as am I, and she's about 6 foot tall. She went and stood there and turned like he said this creature did. And this gentleman, he was so upset. You know, this, I interviewed them not, you know, it wasn't like that day or anything, but it was within a few months of what happened. He started crying, and I will never forget this because his dog got really upset, was whining and trying to like jump on him because he was shaking and was so upset. And his wife was trying to calm him down and stuff. He got embarrassed, I think, and he kind of moved off a little bit to collect himself because what he said later was that my friend that stood there was so much smaller and so, you know, just tinier compared to what he saw. It just really freaked him out, for lack of a better word. But I talked to his wife as he went to collect his feelings, and she's like, this is just not like him. You know, he's not somebody that lets that show. And I said, well, when this happened, did he call you right away? You know, what happened right afterwards? And she said that he had called her in the middle of the night, just hysterical about it, really upset about all of this, went home. He has never missed a day of work in his life. And after he saw the thing, he missed 2 days of work, wouldn't go back to that site. And to me, like that, to me, what struck me the most was that dog's reaction. Like, this guy was not like faking me out here. Yeah. Like, he was legitimately upset. His dog was upset, you know. And I'm getting like a little bit of chills here telling you the story because it just was very visceral reaction. So, you know, this guy, he works in the woods. He's seen those black bear. He's seen people, you know, and he swears that he saw Bigfoot in the woods of Pennsylvania. It's very hard for me. See, today is a day that I think they're real. telling you that story, because I'll never forget just his emotion with that.
Yeah, I think it is very compelling, especially when someone has such an emotional reaction to it, because often, as we referred to and we've mentioned there, Amy, people will often say, oh, these people are just making things up. And yet, why would someone, a complete stranger who you've never met in your life before this, tell you a story that causes him to break down in front of you and he's so upset he has to go away to compose himself to come back?
Right.
And as you say, if he's lying, he's clearly such a good actor that he's fooling his own dog.
Yes. That's what was so compelling to me for that one, because that dog was not happy. You know, she was jumping and just trying to, you know, get her owner to calm down, for lack of a better way of putting it. So, yeah, it was very compelling.
Yeah. So when did you get the bug in regards to trying to collate field reports and interviews with people, Amy? Was it something that after your initial sighting, you kind of spent a year or so just sort of researching it and thinking just how common are Bigfoot in this area? Or was it something you basically dove in with both feet and thought, right, let's find out as much as we can here?
Well, I dove in with both feet as far as trying to find out things by reading. Like, I read every book I could find. I read every report I could find online. It took me about a year before I put in my own report online to the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization.
Yeah.
And I almost didn't put it in there because I thought, well, mine was stupid. I was like, I'm not sure what it was. It was far away. You know, maybe they wouldn't even want to know about it. But it ended up that someone did give me a call. And so that, you know, was kind of my intro to there were other people that were really looking into this. But I pretty much kept in the background for a while. I would go hear other people speaking about it. You know, we have frequent little Bigfoot events. Now I'm in charge of some of them. You know, but back then, you know, somebody would give a library talk or something and I'd go listen because I was really intrigued. So it started out that way. And then after a few years, I was invited to be in the BFRO myself and become one of their investigators. So when I did, I really started looking into those reports because, you know, they have a database, but their database is huge underneath what's shown to the public because there's a backlog of reports that people have to go through. So I spent a couple of years with them where I interviewed everybody I possibly could. First in Ohio, and then I moved on to Pennsylvania because I think I might have already said this, but that's actually where I spend more of my time. I have my own little, you know, people have their little research areas, if you want to say that, but I have my own little one where I grew up going to my grandpa's hunting cabin in the Alleghenies. And there are a lot of reports that came out of there. So I'm like, oh, okay, I'm gonna focus here. It's almost like we call it like a micro study. But I spent a few years with them. We parted ways. I was going to just do my own thing. And then I got that call from the Olympic Project, you know, if I wanted to kind of be an offshoot for them out here. So
you won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
I said, I'm never going to be in a group again. I'm going to do my own thing. But no, I'm so pleased. I'm pleased with my own judgment that I said yes. And I had known Shane and Derek Randles and David Ellis, you know, before they asked me in there. I had been out there a few times and all of that. So, it's been a progression. And now I actually get a lot of reports just sent directly to me. So those are the ones that I more focus on.
Yeah. Is it something that you're still constantly surprised when you come across people that have encounters or reports that come through to you, Amy, that maybe are a little more unusual than that? Or is it simply the fact that in this day and age, people seem to be more open and honest about an experience, as you refer to there, the gentleman that you've spoken to? Because for a lot of people, sometimes they just keep it bottled up for years and years and years. I mean, there are several reports of people that had incidents that happened to them, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and they've basically held this in for so long that it just eventually bursts out of them.
Yeah, I think for me, my perspective is a lot of people just haven't had anybody to tell their stories to. You know, maybe they told their wife, or maybe they told their friend and they were kind of giggled at or whatever, and then they've kept it bottled up, like you said. But when given the chance, I think a lot of people are more open than you might think. And yes, I am actually surprised about that. The first hunting show that I did, I went the night before to set up my booth, and I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I'm like, okay, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if all these men, especially, there's some women, you know, like, power to the women hunters and stuff, more than you would think. But mostly, I would say you get men that come to these shows. And I didn't know if I was going to get tomatoes thrown at me or, you know, or what. But I'm like, I'm going to try. So I was there the night before and I was putting down this green carpet that the organizer wanted each of the booths to have. And so I'm crawling around on my hands and knees and I look up and there's several men standing there in their camo and everything. And I'm like, oh, what's going on? What it ended up was there were a bunch of the vendors from other booths. You know, you had people that take people out big game hunting, or they're selling archery equipment or whatever. And there were about five of them. They were standing there and they wanted to tell me their stories because they saw my Bigfoot sign. Yeah. So it was the night before it even opened. And I had people, hey, I heard something. Hey, I saw something. And then every time, the next day is that first time. And every time we go back, we are busy the entire time with people stopping by and telling their stories. So Tina and I will say that we feel sometimes like we're doing a service just to listen to people and let them get something off of their chest. Because we don't make fun of them, you know, no matter what they say. I don't care if they say, you know, I was bow hunting. I saw something through my scope or whatever, and it's a very physical creature they see. Or sometimes you get people that have stories that seem a little more unusual,
yeah.
You know, like, and I'll listen to that too, because I don't claim to know what Bigfoot is, if they do exist. I am interested in them as a real, natural, living and breathing creature. That's my focus and that's my interest. But you know that there's a whole other side of people that think it's something more supernatural, or maybe even an alien or something like that. And I don't make fun of that, because I don't know. I don't know. I tend to think that, you know, a lot of times something that somebody might think is paranormal has a scientific explanation for it, but maybe we just don't know what that is yet.
Uh-huh.
But I will never make fun of somebody for something that sounds outlandish, because how do I know? I don't know. You know, like I said, there's no experts.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think it's very cathartic for people, as you refer to there, in regards to the fact that people can come forward and finally unburden themselves from this? Because often, I think in any aspect of life, Amy, regardless of what the subject matter is, keeping something inside that has created such an emotional response in you is often damaging to that person, regardless of what it may be. And yeah. So when you're dealing with this, do you find that these people feel relieved that they've unburdened this, like you say? Because I suppose as well, being a woman, it can be quite daunting when you're dealing with men's men, you know, who are out hunting with all kinds of experiences and different, you know, as you refer to there, different types of preferred weapons and things like that. And I suppose for you as well, that can be quite daunting. And yet here you have these men who are very happy to kind of come forward and say, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to tell you about it, and probably feel so much better by letting go.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, some people are just happy to tell their story and they get really excited about it, you know, and it's they have told other people about it and they just want to share. But you do get a lot of those people. I think cathartic is a really good way of putting it, that it is cathartic to them, because you can see it. You can feel that emotion coming from them. And as far as the, you know, being women doing this, I do think there's something to that. You know, we, Tina and I, do not look like threatening at all. You know, we're just sitting there, hey, you know, tell us your story. You know, we're kind of goofy goofballs in a way, but
yes,
people kind of respond to that. And Tina is, I always say she's the secret weapon, because she's been hunting and fishing her whole life. So she can shoot the breeze, we say, you know, with, oh, like, what lures did you use? What, you know, what kind of, I don't know, whatever hunting terminology you want to use. Like, he knows all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, my grandpa was a hunter. I, you know, I've been around that, but I myself am not one. You know, I'll eat your venison if you kill a deer, but I don't do it myself.
Yeah.
You know, so we have our own strengths that we bring to that. So she often makes people feel very comfortable with her being able to use that correct lingo that I might be a little bit at a loss for.
Yeah.
Another thing is that, you know, when I first started doing this, you know, I grew up going to my grandpa's hunting cabin that I mentioned, but it was a cabin, you know, you're inside, you don't have to do a lot.
Yes.
And I was like, I want to get out in the forest, but I was totally unprepared for it. So, you know, I had never put a tent up by myself. So that first time I put my tent up and I made a fire out of a Duraflame log, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was like, okay, I can do this much, so I'm going to learn a little more. So since then, you know, over these last 9 or 10 years, I started taking classes. I'm now an Ohio certified volunteer naturalist, because I felt very strongly that if I'm going to look for unusual things in the woods, I need to know what the usual things are. If I'm going to listen for unusual sounds, I need to know what normal sounds are. So I put that time in, you know, toward that license. And then I also started taking bushcraft classes, where now I can make a fire, you know, now I can take care of myself better in the woods. And I think you can always learn, because it wasn't natural to me. I love the outdoors. I was never, you know, a super girly girl or anything like that. But I would rely on other people to take care of me, and now I can take care of myself. So now I can take, you know, have a better conversation with people too about, you know, how do you do this? How do you do that? And they open up to you a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that's one of the aspects of cryptozoology and the search for Bigfoot that's often overlooked, because I would imagine that, as you refer to, you were brought up with your grandfather's cabin and his exploits in hunting in the locality. But I would imagine that as an adult and with your normal profession, perhaps you didn't spend as much time in nature as perhaps you did as a child. So has Bigfoot given you a bigger appreciation for nature? And as you refer to, you've become really immersed in what you need to identify out there. So do you think it's kind of opened your eyes to the natural world far more than you could have anticipated?
100%, yes. I used to love being out. I was a little girl. I'd be at the end of our driveway sitting in the mud puddle, you know, getting dirty. I would look for worms and snakes and frogs. And I've always liked animals and nature. You know, my mom's the one that helped us catch the snakes and stuff. And she taught us what the trees were and what the flowers were, wildflowers. So I always loved that, but it definitely got away from me, you know, just with normal life. I didn't go out into nature much at all, except for a walk in our local park, maybe, you know, when I lived up in Cleveland. But now it's a part of me, you know, that I want to get out there as much as possible. And I want to see our beautiful country. I'd love to see more of the world. I've been over in Europe, over to Norway several times, but haven't seen more of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And yes, it has opened up a whole new passion in me that I didn't even really realize was there. So I always say, even if I never find Bigfoot, you know, maybe I'll find a new mushroom, or maybe I'll find a new flower or something like that. And that's thrilling. Like, how cool would that be?
Yeah.
You know, so it, to me, I do a lot of things for children, getting them out into the woods, getting them out into nature and off of their electronics, you know, and to me, that's very fulfilling, because it's not, that part of it is not even about Bigfoot. They are interested in Bigfoot. So where they might not come to a hike to look for owls, they'll come to one to look for Bigfoot.
Yeah.
But the point of it isn't even if they're real or not. It's just to get them to have that passion for our beautiful Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. Use Bigfoot as the lure to get them outside.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yep. We might not find Bigfoot, but hey, there's plenty of other cool things out there that they've probably never even realized.
Yeah, there are. And I feel like when, you know, I go out camping and into the forest by myself a lot now, and I just feel like I can't go out there and my only goal is to find proof of Bigfoot. Mm. You know, the chances of that happening to me, in my mind, are slim. You know, some people go out and they say they find something every time. You know, they see Bigfoot every time, or they hear something every time. That is not my experience. So I always say I'm either the worst Bigfooter in the world, or or I'm just being a little more practical. You know, but I love to do it even if I do see an owl, or if I see a deer, or just enjoy the trees and nature. You know, you know, Shane, I've been out with him in the Mount Hood National Forest with him and a couple other guys. Hmm. And yes, we were hoping, you know, to find some evidence of Bigfoot, but mostly we were just camping and fishing and having fun, you know. So you have to be willing to put in that time, and it's fun time, so why not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to me, because recently I was speaking with Tony Healy, the famous mm-hmm. Australian cryptozoologist and Yowie hunter. And Tony is one of those remarkable people who tells you about his life very, you know, very humbly. you know, and things like when he was 18, he left Australia and went to Canada for 3 years because he was obsessed with Bigfoot and worked in a logging factory. Cool. And you're just like, what? But he was often saying that when he was following up on famous Bigfoot sightings in the US and Canada, often people would say, they would tell him about other phenomena like mystery black cats and things like that, Amy.
Mm-hmm.
He would be told things like this by witness, and they would say to him, he was telling about an incident at Bluff Creek, strangely enough.
Right.
And he was interviewing a witness, and the witness said, oh yeah, we mentioned the Bigfoot, but I kept telling him all about these Black Panthers that come around here all the time. And I think he'd spoken to Rennie Darnhood and John Green, and he said they just weren't interested in these Black Panthers at all. All they wanted to talk about was Bigfoot. And he said, I've seen Bigfoot once in 60 years. He said, I see black cats every other year.
Right, right. No, that's so funny, and that's true. Like, there's more to this than Bigfoot. Yes. I would agree with him very much so. That's funny. I like that story.
So is it something that the more you learn, the deeper your interest becomes, Amy? Because as you say, you know, some days you'll wake up and you question the reality of any of this. But I suppose every time you interview a witness and they give you a compelling account, or you're out with the Olympic Project, or you're in your own secret location doing your own personal field research, I suppose it just re-energizes you and gives you a real thirst for the quest, as it is.
It does, very much. It's so much fun. And every time you hear a story, it re-energizes me 100%. Another thing that has happened is that my interest in Bigfoot has kind of broadened, I guess you would say, where it's not just whether or not there is a real creature, which is what my Project Zoo book is all about. But I also have come to appreciate the history of this search for Bigfoot. So where I had no clue about any of it before, now I, you know, and it came a lot from reading all of those different books by John Green, like you mentioned, and different people, where I'm like, I want to know, like, let's pretend Bigfoot isn't real. You know, like, it doesn't even matter if it is real. What about these people that have spent their lives looking? That is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And so I started focusing in Ohio. I've started, like, looking people up that have done this for way longer than I have. You know, when I first started this, and even to this day, you know, I've been in, like you said earlier, a relatively short time. So I would get a lot of criticism. She doesn't know what she's talking about. She doesn't, you know, she's new. Where my response to that was always, and still is, somebody new could be the one to find the evidence. Like, that does not matter. And so I always encourage people, please don't be put off by those who think they know more than you. Like, they might know more about different methods people try to use, or know more about the history of things, but it doesn't mean that you can't go out and just enjoy nature and look. So I wanted to put that in there, because I still do get a lot of flack about that. But I am interested in the people who have been doing this longer than me. And so I have fortunately become friends with John Keating, who, yes, you know, people call the godfather of Ohio Bigfooting. You know, he was out there doing all of this. So he and I are friends now, and he's told me a lot of, you know, taught me a lot and told me a lot of his stories. I was able to seek out and become friends with Robert Morgan, who, you know, he was doing stuff back in the, you know, 70s, looking for Bigfoot all over the place. And he's still living. He's in the Pittsburgh area of Pennsylvania. And my favorite person that I got to spend time with is a gentleman named Tom Page. A lot of people don't know him or don't know his name, and I'm trying to change that. I had met him briefly at an event several years ago. And after that event, it occurred to me, he was honored for being like the financial backer of Roger Patterson and Peter Byrne after Tom Slick died.
Yes.
And so people were like, you know, that's great. You know, he provided money to help them research, which is true. But in my head, I was like, I wonder if he is more than that. I wonder if he has some stories himself. It took me 2 years to find him. You know, he had used to live quite close to me, and then he moved and I couldn't find him. Finally found him, and we ended up spending a few precious years getting together and having lunch, and he would tell me his stories. And I was right. He wasn't just the money behind this. He got involved because he very much wanted
to find a Bigfoot himself. So although he was a well-to-do businessman, so he could financially back some different expeditions and stuff, he went on them as well. So I'm currently writing a book about him. Unfortunately, he passed away last year. It was pretty devastating to me. You know, he was in his 90s and just, you would never, like, he was sharp as a tack even toward the end. So I have a lot of audio that I recorded of him telling me his stories and different things that he gave me telling his stories. And so I'm in the process of writing a book about him. So that was a long answer to your question. But yeah, it's I love the interviews. I adore being out there and looking myself, you know, being the one out in nature myself. But I also am a writer and I love the history of all of it. So it's all kind of together now.
Yeah, I must admit, every time I stumble across a new book, I'm fascinated by reports that I've never come across before. You know, as you say, Amy, I'm no expert, and I've been criticized for having an interest in this and living in England,
right,
which I find odd, but
yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, my first cryptozoological love was the Loch Ness Monster. I read a book about it and wrote a report about that in junior high school. And I was even supposed to go over to Inverness to be an exchange student my junior year in high school. And then I got sick and I couldn't go. But no, I mean, I was interested in Nessie. You're allowed to be interested in Bigfoot.
Thank you. I think that's a fair swap.
Yep.
And it is, because as you touch on there, Don Keating is someone that I was aware of really when the birth of satellite television started bringing us over here programs like Monster Quest and things like that. And I remember Don being on one of those particular shows, and then Don seemed to really lose his enthusiasm for the subject, I think, because he seemed to get really fed up of people just pulling his leg, I think. And I know you were saying recently, when you were interviewed on the Marvelous Sasquatch Tracks with Micah Hanks and the team, that Don was making his return to public speaking, because I don't think he'd really done anything for quite a while, had he?
No, he hadn't. You know, part of it, I'm sure, was what you said about people pulling his leg and stuff. And part of it was, as in any place that you gather people together. So it could be a knitting club. It could be a bicycle club. But the Bigfoot community, in my opinion, and I think John would agree with me here, eats its own a lot.
Yes.
So he had to put up with a whole lot of grief from people inside the community, because unfortunately, not everybody is just trying to find evidence and just trying to share evidence, and not everybody is a good person. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
And he, you know, some people that weren't very good people kind of screwed him over. I don't know how else to say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that's in the past, and I'm so glad that he is back out, you know, out in the woods. You know, if nothing else, I'm just happy that he's back out in the woods and having fun. But he did. He spoke at the Sasquatch Triangle Conference in Coshocton, Ohio in April. And I didn't get to go because I had been very ill. I'm recovering. Mm. But he did a phenomenal job from everything I've heard. People were thrilled, you know, to hear from him again. And I'm just very honored to call him a friend of mine.
Yeah, I think the field was less for his lack of visibility, Amy. I have to completely agree. I think Don's someone, whenever I'd heard him speak or discussing his investigations or his reporting or anything like that, Don was someone I would always be very interested in hearing, because he always struck me as a very measured, once again, down-to-earth, balanced researcher, no whistles and bells. Don would tend to just say it as it was, and that would be it. And so when you mentioned it, I'd kind of kept my eye on it. And ironically enough, I've recently made his acquaintance as well and had a brief chat with him. And it's one of those things about doing this show, is I get the opportunity to speak to people that I have so much respect for. I remember speaking to Peter Byrne and I was shaking like a leaf, you know?
Yeah.
Because Peter was somebody that, as a child, I was aware of out there then 40, 50 years ago, you know? And so to get the opportunity to speak to people like that, you know, and Stan Gordon and people of that ilk, I just find it mind-blowing that these people are happy to have a conversation with me.
And they are. They're very down-to-earth people. So, no, I feel you. Like, I even knew about Peter Byrne and I wasn't into Bigfoot, you know? Like,
yes.
Peter Byrne. So I had coffee with him a few times out in Oregon, and I just...
oh, I don't even know what to say about it. So I feel the same way.
Absolutely. He's definitely the rock god of the Bigfoot field, I think, Peter.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it's one of those things, I know you mentioned it there, slightly earlier. How did Project Zoo Book come to pass then? Because I know this is quite an interesting project that you are the co-founder of, and it's one of those groups that seems to be very forward thinking in the way that it's trying to do its research, and once again seems to be a very collective effort in regards to what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I was lucky. A lot of the things, I will be the first to admit, a lot of the things that I've been honored and privileged to be a part of when it comes to Bigfoot, I've been lucky over. People will call me and ask me, like, how did you get to do this? How did I said I was lucky and I looked for opportunities and I'm nice to people. Those are my three secrets. Or I try to be nice to people, you know, like try to yes. be a good person. So that's it. But as far as Project Zoo Book, I am not in as many or not as active in as many Facebook Bigfoot groups as I used to be, but there are a lot of them, which I'm sure you know. And so I would spend some time on Facebook kind of haunting different groups to see what was going on. You know, sometimes you can pick up on some cool research that's going on. And I happened into one where there was an expedition coming up and there was a young lady who was asking like how much it was to go on this expedition and the logistics of it and stuff. And I noticed over the course of a few days that nobody had answered her. So although I wasn't in charge of that expedition, I was helping with it. So I private messaged her and I said, hey, I saw your question. Did anybody answer you? Do you have any other questions? And she said, no, I haven't heard back. I'm going to try to make a really long story short. Ended up, we struck up a little bit of a conversation. I never looked at her Facebook page, so I didn't know what she did or anything like that. She told me that she and her co-workers were interested in Bigfoot, so they had kind of wanted to go on this expedition. It ended up that this one did have a fee and they couldn't afford it. And I told her, I was like, shh, don't tell anybody, but you don't have to pay to go look for Bigfoot. I said, you could just go, like, you can just go camping. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this official expedition. I'm using air quotes here.
Yes. That's
so I said, you can just like go, like it's something free to all. So I had told her, well, that's cool that you and your coworkers are interested, because my coworkers make fun of me, you know? So I said, that's nice that you're interested. And I told her, I said, well, if I'm ever near you or if you're ever in Ohio or anything, I'd be happy to go camping with you guys and we'll just have fun. So long story short, it ended up that she told me a few weeks later, I think it was, I get my times and stuff off sometimes, that she worked at a zoo. And not only did she work at a zoo, but she was a keeper for the primates. And that all of the coworkers she was talking about were primate keepers at this zoo. And I was shocked because I was like, just, you know, I don't know what I was expecting her to be, but that wasn't it, you know?
Yeah.
And she said that they had been trying to find somebody to talk to them about Bigfoot, like from the Bigfooting world. They had emailed several people. Nobody ever got back to them. And I was like, my jaw was on the floor because I'm like, wow, this is like such a great resource of information. You know, they work with gorillas, they work with chimpanzees, macaques, different primates and great apes. So it ended up that I was like, well, if you want information and you want, you know, to talk to people about this, I'll get you some people. Because by then, you know, I had met Derek Randles and Shane Corson. I had met a lot of people, you know, Ron Moorhead, a lot of people in the Bigfooting community. And so I was like, well, we could have like little phone calls where, because they don't live in my same state, where we could talk about it, you know. So it started very simply. And I invited a few other researchers. I talked to Shane. I think he was one of the first people that talked to them. And we would have these little calls. So like over, I think we started over Skype, you know, something like that, like we're doing today.
Yeah.
And it just grew, you know, it started growing. We have these little concentric circles where we have our little core group, and then people kept coming in and coming in. And we, you know, we have to be, a lot of people haven't heard about Project Zoo Book, and I'm always fine with that because we have to be a little discreet, because
what we always say is that even though our scientists that are involved are all very interested in Bigfoot, it doesn't mean the boards of their zoos or universities would be okay with that.
Yes.
So we make it a safe place, you know, for people to talk. And if you flash forward a few years to now, you know, at that time, we're like, well, maybe we should call ourselves something, you know, and we were laughing about it, you know. And somebody suggested Project Zoo Book. So it was kind of like the equivalent to Project Blue Book with aliens, yes. You know, being undercover. So we were like, ha, ha, ha. And then my sister made us a logo, and all of a sudden we're like this official group, you know. And you flash forward to now, and we've had so many wonderful people that have taken part. And now we are through Zoom, and we get to see each other. Mm-hmm. And the last call we had, I think we had 21 people, mostly scientists. So we have zookeepers, we have primatologists, we have anthropologists, we have biologists, you know, wildlife biologists, we have, marine biologists, you know, who, so we've even started talking about lake monsters and stuff like that, but it's mostly Bigfoot, but who have an interest in this. And not all of the scientists think that Bigfoot is real or, you know, are convinced. But I will tell you that every single time we've had a scientist on one of our calls, we call ourselves a think tank. Mm-hmm. Not one of them has said, I don't want to come back. You know, they usually always say, I had no idea that all of this research was going on. I had no idea so many people were seeing these things, kind of like me at the beginning of this. And I'm not a scientist. I'm just the coordinator of Project Zoo Book, you know, but
you won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
You know, I didn't know that there was all of this evidence collecting going on and stuff, and they're the same way. So we just keep getting bigger, and it's been awesome. We're starting a website. It's not functional yet. We are, you know, we have different people going out speaking. And I speak a lot around the United States, and my main reason for doing that is not to hear myself talk, but to try to get other scientists involved.
Yeah.
So it's just been a pleasure. We're hoping to get some scholarly articles written up about different things. We are working on getting, like, pairing researchers with scientists for some micro studies, and it just keeps going and going. And so, you know, I think I had sent this to you, but in 2019, I think it was 2019, I believe, I was out at the, what's it called? The International Bigfoot Conference out in Washington State. And I walked into the auditorium right when Russ Acord was saying that I won the Dedicated Researcher Award for that year. And what was funny, and I'm not saying that to be like, ooh, look at me. I'm saying that because I really didn't think I deserved that. But what was funny was nobody knew who I was. And they're all like, okay, who is she and what is she doing? And I felt bad because especially at that point, we really weren't saying what we were doing. It was very hush-hush because of the privacy of our scientists. Mm. So it was funny because people were like politely clapping, but they're like, who is this woman, you know, getting this award? But, you know, we are starting to blossom, I guess, out there. And some of our scientists are able to come out of the Bigfoot closet, I call it, and, you know, go talk and speak different places. So it's just been, I hope you can tell in my voice that I'm very enthusiastic about it, but it's been very fun and informative collaboration. And we work with the Olympic Project, and we've started to work with some different people that have their own small groups. And that's just my favorite thing is when, you know, like I said, I'm the coordinator of it. I'm not the brains involved. I sit back and I listen to evolutionary biologists talking to a taxonomist who's doing some mapping studies and stuff, and they're talking about collaborating together. And then I just want to do like a little cheer, because that's all that I hoped for when we first started this.
Yeah, I think people will be surprised, Amy, that people are sort of involved in this with a scientific background, because I think often, as with any kind of field that deals with things outside of the normal parameters of what science, I'm doing air quotes now, science is is supposed to be, these subjects are pushed to the fringes. And it would seem that, as you refer to there, when you're talking about some of the members of Project Zubuk and what their boards may view their extracurricular activities as, I find it both refreshing and frustrating that these people have a clear interest in this subject but can't come forward due to the ridicule and the professional snobbery that would occur in regards to that.
Yeah, it is frustrating. It really is. And they are frustrated as well. You know, they'll say that to you. One thing that I learned pretty quickly, and I was like, okay, I hadn't thought about this before, is that most of the time, good scientists are open-minded. You know, you go where the facts take you. And whether that is, in the end, Bigfoot exists or it doesn't, or we'll never be sure, okay. But most good science would back that up. But the problem in a lot of cases is money. And so, like, say, you know, we have a marine biologist and she works for a certain university. And so if she's interested in looking into lake monsters or something, doesn't mean that she'll get the funding for that. And so she has to spend her time on things that she's still interested in, but maybe not that particular passion, because they just won't get funded. So a lot of times, what we have been told with these different scientists I work with now is that that's the problem. It also is the stigma, 100%. You know, you're a gorilla primatologist, you know, you're studying gorillas and you say, hey, I want to find out if Bigfoot's real, you might get all of your backing taken away.
Yes.
And, you know, and they don't want to risk that. So, you know, it stinks. You have people like Dr. Meldrum, you know, who are able to stand up and say, hey, I am interested in this. I'm studying this, like it or not. You know, he has his, you know, his time into that university, so he can do that. And he's aware, you know, and we've talked about, he and I have talked about that, that it's frustrating that some of our Zubuk scientists can't do that yet, but they're, you know, not to his level where they're not going to get in trouble. So it is very frustrating, but it is very refreshing as well that there's so many people that really are like fascinated by the topic as well.
Yeah. And I think it is, as we're currently seeing at the moment in regards to ufology, Amy, that's the same kind of thing, because anybody that dared to come forward and with a scientific background saying that they had an interest in UFOs, UAPs, aliens, whatever, would just be ridiculed and, as I've heard you mention before, labelled as cracked.
Right. My grandma used to call everybody cracked.
Yeah. And that applies to anything that is deemed to be on the fringes. I've been speaking to a couple of paranormal researchers, and once again, we were discussing the work that's going on in certain well-known universities around the world in regards to the paranormal and parapsychology, that to the average person, nobody in the scientific community is interested in these subjects, because that's what people are told. There is no interest from the science in Bigfoot and lake monsters and UFOs and ghosts and things like that. But when you find the right people and you talk to them, that's simply not true. All these disciplines, people are deeply interested and fascinated with them, even on a cultural basis, Amy. And
yes,
there are so many reports that apply to all these different disciplines that to dismiss everything out of hand as mental illness or misidentification or fabrication, I think, is as ludicrous as someone claiming that they've seen flying objects flying around the skies. Mm-hmm. What is as ridiculous? It's that they're two ends of a spectrum that are as bad, in my opinion. And for someone that was brought up in a house that Yeah, my parents, one was a believer, one was a skeptic, so I had a foot in both camps. And as you referred to earlier, there are lots of different subparts to the Bigfoot phenomenon in regards to what people believe, be it interdimensional beings and paranormal entities or alien visitors or real flesh and blood creatures. And yet your approach is very balanced, that you will respect these people's beliefs and views regardless. Whereas, yeah, as you pointed out earlier, I am very aware that if you want to see a big fight in the Bigfoot community, you just put a paranormal person and a flesh and blood person in the same room and just see the sparks fly normally.
Right, right. And it's unfortunate. It's really unfortunate because you have so many good people in both camps, first of all. And I don't know why. It just irritates me when somebody thinks they know everything. You know, it just irritates me because we don't know everything. We don't know everything that's out there. We don't know everything that could be out there. And so, you know, if you ever catch me saying, oh, I know what Bigfoot is, then you have my permission to slap me because it's not true. It's not true. And there's so many things we don't know how things work, you know. My one example is, did you ever see that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy?
Yes.
Where the cola bottle gets thrown out of the airplane and then the natives think, the gods sent this, you know. What if it's something like that? We just don't understand what is going on. It's not really paranormal. We just don't understand what is going on when there's a certain issue like that's reported. You know, you get people that say the Bigfoot disappeared. So what if it's like a trick of the eye with the fur, you know, and how the sun is on it or something, you know, or what if they can do that? And we just don't know how that works. I don't know, you know, I don't know much, but I just think it's wrong to dismiss people out of hand, especially when you're talking about something like Bigfoot, because we have all been made fun of no matter how scientific we think we are in our approach. A lot of people are still going to make fun of us. So why would we do that to somebody else? You know, it just bothers me.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, we live on the same planet as octopuses, which if you study octopuses for any length of time, you will just be astounded at, they seem to have no limits to their abilities, whether it's, you know, as you refer to there, the camouflage aspect of an octopus. I'm still, my mind is boggled every time I see an octopus pretend to be a beach or a rock or a different kind of creature even. I mean, it's fascinating. And yet anything else we just dismiss, or some people certainly dismiss completely out of hand, Emmy. And yet the natural world around us will constantly surprise us. And there are numerous examples of creatures that have camouflage ability that seems to be almost magical.
Exactly. Yes, very well put. That's just how I feel. Why couldn't there be something we just don't know about yet, you know? So I agree.
Absolutely. Well, I think the last aspect I'm going to keep hold of you for is, obviously, as someone that's had the privilege and the excitement of going out to certain places, what's on your Bigfoot bucket list? Because I know you've had to kind of, as most people have, had to kind of put things on hold. You more so than others, Amy, unfortunately, as you've been quite ill with COVID recently. So in regards to getting back out there and when things begin to sort of resemble what we could call normal, if hunting for Bigfoot could ever be under that umbrella, regardless of your opinion of it, where are the places you want to go next? Because I know I've heard you mention that you've had an invitation in regards to, I believe it was Arizona, and I think you've mentioned you'd love to go up to Alaska as well.
Yes, you got it. You know, well, first of all, I want to say someday I'm going to get over to Loch Ness. But besides that, as far as Bigfoot goes, I do have a bucket list, and my number one place would be to go to British Columbia. I would love to go there and just spend some time, you know. That's my number one wish, is to go there and, you know, Vancouver Island, looking out there for Bigfoot. Yeah, I had some opportunities that I was so excited about that got squashed because of COVID, as we all have, like you said, and hopefully someday they will reappear. But I was supposed to be out in Alaska for a few different things over the last 2 years. I was going to be going to Prince of Wales Island, mm-hmm. and I was going to be going to Port Chatham, which is probably my number two place that I would love to go. You know, that fishing village that everybody disappeared from because they said the hairy man came and was killing people. And, you know, I had friends, Adam Davies and Larry Baxter and Stephen Major, that made it out there. And I would have loved to have made it. So that's on my bucket list. And then, yes, I was supposed to be out west with the Navajo. Yes. You know, I have a good friend who works with the Navajo, and they have this particular tribe has its own, for lack of a better way of putting it, like its own Bigfoot branch of their local police unit, where they deal with Bigfoot and sightings and things like that. So that's what I've been told anyway. So I was supposed to go out there and just kind of meet the people. And then if they liked me and trusted me, then I would get to come back and talk more about Bigfoot. And so that was an extreme disappointment that that didn't happen, because I have such respect for our Native Americans and our First Nations over here in North America. And they are probably the biggest reason that I think Bigfoot could be real, is the fact that it wasn't just with the Patterson-Gimlin film that this whole topic started. You go back in their history, and so many different tribes will say, you know, yes, it's real. It's as real as an eagle. It's as real as an antelope. It's not just part of our mythology. Although they do have stories, you know, mm-hmm. moral tales that have to do with Bigfoot. But a lot of them are about living, breathing creatures. And so I would really love to go and visit the Navajo and other nations as well.
Yeah, I think that's such an untapped resource. But once again, I think that's one of those situations, Amy, where they've closed ranks over it because of the ridicule they've got. And
right.
I mean, I'm fortunate a few months ago to have managed to purchase the wonderful yet extremely hefty Historical Bigfoot by Chad Arnott.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a wonderful book, but it's a killer to try and read in bed, unless you work out, because it's so hefty.
It's really big, yes.
But that is a phenomenal aspect of it all, and that's one of the things that often frustrates me. And like you say, I'm no expert at all, but I love the history of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, especially because of the fact that if you go past the modern cultural explosion, for some people, Bigfoot appeared in 1957-58, and nothing occurred before that. And anybody with a real interest in the subject knows that that's nonsense, because there are, well, as Chad's book shows, thousands of reports that predate that. And once again, you have such an oral tradition in the First Nation and Native American cultures that there clearly has to be something to it, because the other aspect of all that is that these tribes were so spread out across the continent that there was no way that these people could be swapping stories, because they probably never even mm-hmm. met. They probably didn't even know they existed. So I find it very odd that cultural tribes from thousands of miles apart have identical stories. They have different names for the creature, but their experiences and their stories are exactly the same.
Right, I agree. There's another book, I don't know if you've read it, but it's by a guy named Leon Fowler, I think, and it's almost like an anthology. He did a lot of research into any Native American reference to Bigfoot that he could find. Uh-huh. And it's really, really interesting. And that will suck you down that rabbit hole for sure, because it's just like a big scope of every reference, like I said, that he could find. And then you look at that and you're going to, oh, I'm going to read that, and then I'm going to read that, and that and that. So that's something I highly recommend for sure.
Yeah. If there's one thing doing this show has done for me is that I have built up a considerable library on a variety of subjects.
Me too.
I am doing my very best for authors in the cryptozoological field, Amy.
that is wonderful of you. So interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm always good for a rabbit hole. So what's next for you once you get back out there? Have you got anything else planned other than trying to achieve your bucket list?
Yeah, you know, I was supposed to be, not this weekend, but the weekend after, I was supposed to be speaking out at the Medellin Falls Bigfoot Conference in Washington State, and I had to cancel. Very sad about that, but as you said, I've been struggling with the after effects of COVID. I got it in February, and it caused a lot of heart problems for me, but I'm working with the Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the best heart hospital in the world, they say. And they're getting me better. So
good.
I had to cancel several things for this year, but I definitely have some plans, especially more toward the fall. I just probably won't be roaming too far from home this year, but there's always next year. And I very much hope to get out to Alaska is my first big thing I want to do.
Yeah, that Port Chatham case is always intrigued and frightened me. And I saw Adam's documentary, because Adam's someone I've got to know as well over the years.
He's great. He's a good friend of mine. I love Adam. He's a great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So Adam's someone, as soon as he's interested in something, I always take it seriously. And it's such a chilling story as well, because that's one of those where you've got tales of extremely aggressive interactions.
Yes. Yes. And those are the ones where all my friends are like, why in the world do you want to go there? But I want to go. Like, I want to see. I am not very brave in that I will be in my tent at night about crying because I think I'm going to be eaten by something. But I do it anyway. So I'm like, okay, if this is how I end, it's how I end. But I want to see if I can see something.
Yeah. My brother's often said if I ever get the chance to go bigfooting, I'm going to be that guy that gets eaten.
Well, if it's not you, it's going to be me. So.
Oh, well, Amy, listen, thank you so much. Where can everybody keep up to date with you? And if they've got any stories they want to share or experiences, how can they get hold of you?
Thank you so much. Yes, I don't want it to be, I would love to speak to anybody who's a scientist, especially in the natural scientist, but I love to hear stories from normal people and researchers and all of that. So anybody can get a hold of me if you go to, my email is Bigfoot Amy, so it's bigfootamy@gmail.com. So that's pretty easy.
Fabulous. And I'll put that on the show notes for anybody that wants to drop you a line.
Thank you so much.
Well, Amy, it's been an absolute pleasure and a delight to finally get a chance to speak to you. You are always welcome to come back, and I hope you would like to do so at some point.
I would love to. This has been lovely. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
You are very welcome. You take care. Get well soon. All the very best. And I will look forward to seeing what else comes our way in your investigations. You take care, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye, Paul.